So I'm not a Beckett scholar, so I will try to engage Beckett in a general discussion about brain damage in literature. So my main question will be, to what extent can cases of brain damage be written and how? I mean, can they be narrated as such, or do they require another type of literary elaboration? So narrativity will be my topic. And I will try to show that Beckett plays a major role in this discussion. So let's start with narration. What do I mean by that? Oliver Sacks was the first to think deeply about the style and function of writing proper to the neurological case history. He claims that, like psychoanalytic cases such as Dora or the Wolfman, cases of brain damage should have their own form of narrativity. In his preface to The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, Sacks shows that the tradition of clinical writing, which reaches its climax with Freud, gradually declined during the second half of the 20th century with the birth of what he calls the impersonal neurological science and the weakening of psychoanalysis. Indeed, for him, it is necessary to weave the patient's coolness, indifference, and the disintegration of emotion into a narrative intrigue that must not be disaffected itself. His claim is that stylistic indifference is not the adequate response to subjective indifference. For Sacks, clearly, narrative work is a clinical gesture, to the extent that, according to him, the act of writing should be able to reintroduce coherence within the damaged identities. And we'll see that the problem is that in cases of brain damage, the patient's reactions are, of course, not at all the same as in psychoanalytic kind of narratives. It is not the same kind of damage. So according to Oliver Sacks, it is necessary to make people with brain damage into cases in the strong sense. That is, into paradigms, into mirrors in which we learn to look at ourselves. The tradition of clinical tales, according to Sacks, must then be endowed with a new life and granted a new destiny. He recalls Luria. Luria is the great Russian neurobiologist. He recalls Luria's observation that, I quote, "the power to describe, which was so common to the great 19th century neurologists and psychiatrists, is almost gone now. It must be revived," end of quote. And Luria reacted to this loss by composing what he called, for the first time, neurological novels, of which The Man with a Shattered World and The Mind of a Mnemonist are the most famous examples. The first of these two novels recounts the story that a man wounded in the war, named Zadzeski, tells of his own mutilated life. Gravely wounded in 1943 by bomb fragments, he assumes the task of telling, I quote, "the story of an instant that destroyed a whole life, the story of a bullet that penetrated a man's skull, damaged his brain, and shattered a world, leaving him irremediably dislocated," end of quote. The wound caused massive damage to the parieto-occipital region of the left hemisphere of the brain, and Luria showed how all aspects of the patient's life were themselves fragmented by the bomb fragments. Zazetsky finds himself plunged into chaos. He had become amnesiac and struggled with aphasic disturbances. He can no longer see nor even imagine his right side. In the face of these and many other difficulties, he set to writing a journal of his injury. And Sacks writes, because Sacks wrote the preface to that novel, I quote Sacks, "such an enterprise, picturing and at the same time anatomizing a man, the dream of a novelist and a scientist combined was first realized by Freud. And Freud's magnificent case histories instantly spring to mind when one reads Luria. Luria's case histories, indeed, can only be compared to Freud's in their precision, their vitality, and their wealth and depth of detail. Though, of course, they're also quite different, as neuropsychology is different from psychoanalysis. Both explore fundamentally the nature of man. Both are new ways of thinking about human nature. Sachs affirms that his own practice of clinical writing was inspired by Luria's neurological novels. Sachs compares his patients to characters in epic narratives. He says, they are heroes, victims, martyrs, warriors. We may say that they are travelers to unimaginable lands, lands of which otherwise we should have no idea or conception, end of quote. Each case history in his book, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, presents one of these travelers. The problem of such case histories is how to do justice in the very writing of the cases to the rupture of narrativity that ultimately characterizes each one, to the destructive power that they each manifest. To the hero of the man with the man with a shattered world declares, I have become a stranger since I was wounded. Everything that I learned or experienced in life has just dropped out of my mind and memory, vanished for good, leaving behind nothing but an atrocious brain ache. So the question, indeed, is how to discover, again, a mode of expression for such a brain ache, a rhetoric proper to it, which would account for the total change in the personality of the sufferer. But what rhetoric could possibly account for the breakdown of connections, for destructive metamorphoses? Who can write the aphasics novel? Who is able to write the story of losing all affect? What mirror could reflect a brain? And I'm not convinced that narrativity, in the way Sachs presents it, just as just reminded of a few quotes by him, I'm not convinced that narration proper is able to reflect the loss of narrativity which each brain damage case incarnates. So before I come to Beckett, I would like to list a certain number of cases which I found in neurobiological literature which clearly, according to me, express the difficulty of narrating them, both the necessity to write about them and the challenging of narrativity itself. So all these cases I found in Antonio Damasio's who Lois referred to a moment ago, and mostly in his most famous book, Descartes' Error. So Damasio lists a few cases starting from, it is all about the loss of affect, and goes from, let's say the most current one up to the most extreme, severe one. So the first case is X, a nameless patient who is invoked in the introduction to Descartes' Error. And Damasio writes, there was only one significant accompaniment to his decision-making failure, a marked alteration of the ability to experience feelings. Flawed reason and impaired feelings stood out together as the consequences of a specific brain lesion. And it is true that for Damasio, the characteristic of each case of brain damage, every case, is the impairment of emotion, the incapacity to feel anything, this emotional indifference. And X serves as the paradigm for understanding how this failure to feel, is linked to certain lesions that irreversibly impair the ability to experience emotion. A quote from the master again. Neurological patients with damage to the amygdala, it's something in the brain, which is the locus for memory, cannot trigger those emotions, fear and anger. And as a result, do not have the corresponding feelings either. The locks for fear and anger seem to be missing, at least for visual and auditory triggers operating under normal circumstances. So such patients do not experience, of course, joy or love or hatred, but they don't seem either to be afraid, to feel anger or fear. Another case, so I will list a number of them, Elliot, also in Descartes' era, who suffers from frontal lobe damage. So the frontal lobe is the place where emotions are situated. Elliot, I quote, was thoroughly charming, but emotionally contained. He was cool, detached, unperturbed, even by potentially embarrassing discussion of personal events. He's a man with a lively intellect, endowed with an excellent memory for dates, names, political events. He's a good father, a good husband. But suddenly he developed a meningioma that placed increasing pressure on his frontal lobes. And after surgery, the master says Elliot was no longer Elliot. The surgery was a success in every respect, and insofar as such tumors tend not to grow again, the outlook was excellent. But what was to prove less felicitous was the turn in Elliot's personality. When he is confronted with images designed to provoke strong emotions, buildings collapsing during earthquakes, houses burning, people wounded in bloody accidents or on the verge of drowning, Elliot flatly declares that he does not feel anything. So the images cause no reaction whatsoever. So the master concludes again that the emotional life of these patients is extremely impoverished. And this is the main difference with the psychoanalytic cases, where emotions is never absent. In brain damage cases, the difficulty of the therapy comes from the fact that the patients don't care, and they don't even care about their own cure or rehabilitation in a way. The master shows that they all reason in cold blood, and Lois was talking a moment ago about consciousness being linked with the ability to make decisions. And in order to make a decision, you have to feel, in a way, what is good and what is bad. And this patient seems to have lost this interest in decision. Everything, the master shows that for them, everything is just as good as everything else, and that nothing is worth anything. So he tries to play cards with them, and they're not interested in winning. So he tries to tell them, play that card. If you play that card, you will win. And they say, well, we don't care. We don't want to win. So the disturbance of cerebral autoaffection produces a sort of nihilism in the patient, this absolute indifference I was talking about. Another case, so this was disaffection. Another case analyzed by Damasio is absence seizures. Pushed to the extreme, such perturbation can give rise to veritable absences or to suspensions of selfhood. Absence seizures, Damasio explains, are one of the main varieties of epilepsy, in which consciousness is momentarily suspended along with emotion, attention, and adequate behavior. So here again, we find this suspension of emotion. I quote, the stroke suffered by this patient produced damage to the internal and upper regions of the frontal lobe in both hemispheres. An area known as the cingulated cortex was damaged along with nearby regions. The patient had suddenly become motionless and speechless. She would lie in bed often with her eyes open, but with a blank facial expression. The term neutral, helps convey the equanimity of her expression. She was there, but not there. So, again, the master writes, emotion was missing. I have often used the term neutral, he also says, to convey the equanimity of or absence of any facial or emotional expressions. And nothing forced this patient to speak of her mind. Rather, as she recalled, I really have nothing to say. So when the master is trying to talk to this patient, she says, I don't have anything to say because I have no feelings. And the last example I will take is that of, the most extreme of all is anosognosia, which is the inability to recognize one's own illness. So after a stroke, for example, you are paralyzed from the left side of the body, but you're not aware of that, and you deny the paralysis. So the patient no longer receives sensory information coming from the body, but at the same time, this phenomenon creates a lack of awareness, and again, a strange emotional indifference. Damasio, no less dramatic than the oblivion that anosognosic patients have regarding their sick limbs, is the lack of concern they show for their overall situation, the lack of emotion they exhibit, the lack of feeling they report when questioned about it. The news that there was a major stroke is usually received with equanimity, sometimes with humor, but never with anguish or sadness, tears of anger or anger, despair or panic. So the disavowal of illness here is not due to what Freud called negation or denegation, but entirely to brain damage, to a physiological incapacity to admit that you are sick, that you are in danger. And nor can the resulting disruption of self-image be explained in terms of a narcissistic disorder. So the transformation of identity emerges from a sudden isolated event unrelated to other events that constitute an individual life story. So, these cases can be considered paradigmatic because they demonstrate that damage to cerebral autoaffection can severely impair the image of self, produce changes in personality, that it is not possible to take organic lesions into account without the psychic repercussions, but on the other hand, they show that the event, the accident, or the lesion cannot, and this is the main difference with psychoanalysis, cannot be woven into the thread of an individual's history. That is why it is so difficult to narrate them without, in a way, betray their lack of plasticity. So Lois was talking about plasticity a moment ago. Brain damage introduces the idea of a rupture, of a disruption of plasticity when suddenly plasticity is not working. Every time a brain damage occurs, you have like a thread which is cut off. And I think it is not really honest to stitch in a way this cut by a kind of narrativity which again is perhaps not faithful enough to what the patient is undertaking. So the problem is that the cerebral damage is an accident which in itself has no signification. And this is the main difference with a psychoanalytic, disease. For example, a neurosis has always a signification. But you know that for Freud, every accident has more or less a psychic cause. When you have, when you suffer from a brain stroke, what is the reason? How will you be able to reintegrate this accident into your personal history? How can you say that this accident was in a way predetermined by your psychic profile or history? It is impossible. So the problem, again, is how is it possible to narrate these cases without trying to find a signification, without trying to confer a meaning on them? And this is, according to me, well, I admire Sachs very much. I think he's really a great doctor and a great writer. But at the same time, it seems to me that he always tries to reintroduce meaning into the meaningless. For example, if you've read the last book on music, he says music is a way of reintroducing meaning into the damaged brains. But I mean, for most of them, if you know people suffering from Alzheimer's disease, etc., music is just unable to rearrange personal history. So the problem again is, it is absolutely necessary to write these cases, to treat them as psychic disorders, and at the same time, it is impossible to write about them. So how, again, is it possible to narrate these cases without any perspective of conclusion, salvation, or reconciliation? Because as we know, most of them are, irreparable. There's nothing to do against Alzheimer's disease, etc. There's no therapy. Well, there might be a therapy, but no healing. So, this is at this point, I'm sorry, because I come to that very late in my talk, but it seems to me that it is at this point that we might turn toward Beckett, because perhaps he's somebody who's able to help us with this enigma, the necessity to write the cases and at the same time the impossibility to narrate them. And the expression theater of absence, from neurological novel to the theater of absence, the theater of absence is an expression by Damasio in Descartes' era, always. So you understand that neurological novels means the kind of work Oliver Sacks is doing, and the theater of absence is here to designate what Beckett is trying to do. And according to Damasio, Beckett's theater is perhaps the most promising kind of literary possibility to write or to present in a literary form the brain cases. So on many occasions, Damasio compares the disorientation of his patients to that of Winnie, who Lois mentioned also a moment ago, from Beckett's Happy Days, who is the incarnation of what Damasio calls wakefulness without consciousness. And I think this is the important thing in our problem of narrativity. How can you write about a kind of presence, wakefulness, but without consciousness? And also, I would say, but this is perhaps for the discussion later, without consciousness, but also without the unconscious, something which is right in the middle between consciousness and the unconscious, this kind of indifferent wakefulness. And according to Damasio, Beckett is really successful when he describes such a state. Patients with some neurological conditions are awake and yet lack what core consciousness would have added to their thought process, images of knowing centered on the self. So what is impaired is the feeling of oneself. This is this strange state of wakefulness without self. awareness. And Winnie, in the play, you remember, asks, what would I do? What could I do all day long? I mean, between the bell for waking and the bell for sleep. Simply gaze before me with compressed lips. Not another word as long as I drew breath. Nothing to break the silence of this place. So here you have a kind of writing which is not telling anything, which is not recomposing a story, just describing a kind of being there without being there. Theater of absence. Which would be the privileged expression of affective impoverishment and destructive metamorphosis. Its rhetoric comprises figures of interruption, pauses, caesuras, blank spaces, and these blank spaces, which appear in Beckett because you always have pause, long pause, while she does so, no more plucking, etc. So you have pauses in Beckett's writing, which in a way are expressions of the interruptions of the connections, interruptions of neural plasticity when the circulation of energy is paralyzed. So this theater is what the French philosopher Gilles Deleuze, you know that he devoted a long, well, a major article to Beckett, which is called Beckett the Exhausted, Beckett l'Épuisé. Beckett calls the theater of exhausted identity. Said the exhausted identity that which Beckett is staging is the possible born after the exhaustion of all possibles. And I quote Deleuze on that point. And we have to, well, let's admit that Deleuze is talking about brain damage or so. Imagine the sentence start as, for them, for the neural patients, there is no longer any possible. Does he exhaust the possible because he is himself exhausted, the patient? Or is he exhausted because he has exhausted the possible? He exhausts himself in exhausting the possible and vice versa. He exhausts that which in the possible is not realized. He has had done with the possible beyond all tiredness for to end yet again. And for to end yet again is a quote by Beckett. Couldn't these words, which describe the Beckettian character, the exhausted, also perfectly well characterize the neurological patients? This possibility of the exhaustion of the possible, which forms the identity of the exhausted, has nothing to do with the persistence of an interior state, as in Freud. For the exhausted, nothing persists. Or rather, it is the nothing that persists. And you were talking about the nothing a moment ago. And Deleuze writes, one was tired by something, but one is exhausted by nothing. In exhaustion, Deleuze writes again, one combines the set of variables of a situation on condition that one renounce any order of preference, any organization in relation to a goal, any signification. So one has to renounce any signification, and here again we find that the absence of signification. So the theater of absence would be a way of giving voice to exhaustion, to coolness, absence of sense, staging it as an absence of persistence, of revivification, or of regression. So we are now, and this will be my conclusion, in a position to distinguish the rhetoric and narrative technique of psychoanalytic case histories from those of neurological case histories. They are, in fact, incompatible. This will be mine. Well, this is what I think. They are incompatible. Whereas the psychoanalytic narrative of the resistance of the indestructible within destruction privileges the persistence of childhood, the past, psychic destiny, which become recognizable through the disturbance that solicits them, the neurological narrative of the destruction of the resistance to destruction stages the exhausted but surviving resources of a psyche that no longer recognizes itself. The writing of neurological suffering, the theater of absence, or the novel of the brain ache, raises the immense question of the psyche's survival to his own destruction. So just to conclude, I would like to go back to Deleuze again in my conclusion and open the question, enlarge the question, and open it to political concerns. In one of his lectures on Spinoza, devoted to ethics, book three of ethics is about emotions precisely. It's called Concerning the Origin and Nature of Affects. This is Spinoza's title. Deleuze writes, this conception will allow Spinoza to become aware, for example, of a quite fundamental moral and political problem, which will be his way of posing the political problem to himself. How does it happen that people who have power in whatever domain need to affect us in a sad way? The sad passions are necessary. Inspiring sad passions is necessary for the exercise of power. And Spinoza says in the theological political treatise that this is a profound point of connection between the despot and the priest. They both need the sadness of their subjects. Here, you understand well that he does not take sadness in a vague sense. He takes sadness in the rigorous sense he knew to give it. Sadness is the affect insofar as it involves the diminution of my power of acting. Inspiring sad passions is necessary for the exercise of power, Deleuze says. I propose to modify a bit the content of this statement and say that today, in our world and current global political situation, it would be more accurate to declare inspiring indifference is necessary for the exercise of power. Indifference here must be understood as indifference to indifference. It is not an affect, but results, on the contrary, from the loss of all affects. It is a disaffection. A sad or sorrowful passion is still a passion. It diminishes my power of acting, but does not profoundly impair my capacity to be affected. Indifference, on the contrary, is not reversible. It has no opposite. It is not a diminishing of our power of acting, but proceeds from the destruction of the capacity to be emotionally moved. So I wonder if the patients we are talking about, what I was asking, can we see them as mirrors? I think that we can see them as mirrors of our own indifference, of our own potential indifference. Because in a way, I will state to end this presentation that we are all virtually, potentially indifferent. We're all potentially in the process of losing affect. And we do that every day when we become indifferent to so many suffering around us. So I wonder if the brain damaged patients cannot be considered as mirrors for this indifference, which is induced and encouraged in a way, enhanced by political power. I think we are urged to become more and more indifferent. So perhaps the kind of writing that the patients, this kind of patients are, the kind of writing which is necessary to describe these patients should be something between the theater of absence, Becker's theater of absence, and a kind of new political treatise, something between theater and philosophy, something between the theater and political philosophy. I will end with two quotes from, well, by Beckett from The Unnameable. There were times when I forgot not only who I was, but that I was, forgot to be. And another one, the tears stream down my cheeks from my unblinking eyes. What makes me weep so from time to time? There is nothing saddening here. Perhaps it is liquefied brain. So liquefied brain, I think, is perhaps the image or the best metaphor for this new brain literature to come.